From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
I introduced James as the 17th Dallas man exonerated, and right. Of course, instantly, Rick Perry knew who it was.
Who it was, exactly.
And he saw James's hand was trembling. He knew James was very nervous, and he just brushed his hand aside, and he grabbed him and hugged him. And that almost made James fall apart. And he said, well, Mr. Woodard, is the state of Texas doing everything for you that she's supposed to be? And James was going, yes, sir. And yeah, and I was like, no, oh, wait. I said, wait a minute. I said, no. And, you know, and of course I told the governor, I gave the governor a piece of my mind. I said, yeah, he'd be doing much better if you would sign that pardon that's been sitting on your desk for weeks. And James really literally looked at me like I cursed the Pope. Who talks like that to the governor? And he couldn't believe it.
Joyce F. King, broadcaster, columnist, and author of Exonerated, A Brief and Dangerous Freedom, published by River Grove Books. In 2007, King was stunned to find herself asked if she would become one of the first non-jurists to serve on the executive board of directors for the Innocence Project of Texas, a nonprofit devoted to overturning wrongful convictions in the state that leads the nation in DNA exonerations. King's life changed dramatically when the Innocence Project of Texas helped a man named James Lee Woodard win his freedom after his wrongful conviction for a 1980 murder of the woman he loved. At the time, Woodard was exonerated in April 2008. He became the longest-serving inmate in America to be freed by DNA evidence. Woodard didn't know who King was, even though several of the lawyers with the IPOT told him she was on the board of directors. Not long after, Joyce King and Jane Woodard were inseparable. I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Exonerated, A Brief and Dangerous Freedom with Joyce F. King, Part 2, In Black America.
I want readers to know that I absolutely still love James. You don't stop loving a person because they die or they leave you or they go on to live a different life without you. And I always wanted the best for him and for him to have some enjoyment after 30 years of a nightmare wrongful incarceration. And I've had plenty of people tell me, you know, James really did love you. You were the happiness. You were the bright spot. It didn't matter. The $4 million did not compare to Joyce King. And that's what I want readers to come away with, that we did have a great love.
Falsely accused of murdering his girlfriend, James Lee Woodard served 27 years and 4 months in prison. On April 29, 2008, he became the 17th man exonerated by DNA evidence in Dallas County, Texas. That same day he was granted his freedom, Woodard laid eyes on Joyce King. It was the happiest day of his life. Exonerated is a love story. It's a deeply intimate story told from the dual perspective of a non-lawyer who was part of the team and a woman in love. But it's also a story about our criminal justice system and how inmates are treated in our prisons. It's also a story about people who are wrongly convicted do suffer traumatic events and being released to a society that provides them with no services. Freedom does not always equal privilege or rights. Exonerees have no credit history, can't vote until a full pardon is granted, and getting a simple ID card can be difficult. On today's program, we conclude our conversation with Joyce F. King regarding her journey.
Well, the first one scared me to death was just talking to him, and his eyes were wide open, so I just thought he was still with me, but all of a sudden, he just went completely blank, and he's looking right through me, and I said, James, what's the matter? And then I remembered, oh, my God, this is somewhere in the file. This is somewhere in the file. I've got to go back. And so I was thinking in my mind, sure, I've read this. I know this. I know what this is. But no, you can never be prepared for it, no matter how much you've read about a person's background. After he came out of the seizure, he just sort of picked up the conversation right where it left off. And I said, James, tell me what just happened. What do you remember? He said, I bet I went into a seizure, didn't I?
Really?
Yeah, it was so calm about it. But what it taught me was to not panic and to do some research, to find out as much as I could about seizures. And I, you know, the first thing I did was I called my physician and I said, look, I need help. I'm going to need a neurologist that James is comfortable with. And so he was a great help to us. And so we got a good neurologist, and I actually described a lot of what I'd seen, because I'd seen a few before we got there. And I was able to actually take very good care of James. I never called 911 like some people did when they were with him.
Exactly.
I never rushed him to any hospital or doctor. I used to talk James out of his seizures. And in fact, one of the stories in the book is this neurologist who was standing behind me watching me do this, he was simply fascinated by how I was able to calm James down and bring James out of the seizure. He said, I have never seen anything like that in my life.
I found it interesting, as you tell your story, some of the things or services that don't happen to exonerees. When you're paroled, do they have services that provide, you know, housing assistance, job placement? But when you're an exoneree, they just let you out and you have to basically fend for yourself. You have no, you know, have no credit. You have no driver's license. You know, you can't open up a bank account because you don't have any identification. Walk us through that agony in which you had to maneuver with James.
Well, it's a very tough road because there's really no identification as to who this person is.
Exactly.
There's no Social Security card or number that is related to them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was very interesting that the government agencies act like they don't know the person when they know exactly who the person is based on his prison ID number.
Mm-hmm.
So James had been known by a number for 27 years in the Texas prison system, but now you're telling me there's no record of him as a human being. So we have to piece together medical information from the family, birth certificate. But the trouble is, a lot of families have lost that paper documentation.
Exactly.
So James had to be taken to all of these different agencies, and I thought one of the most humorous, which is in the book, was how he got his driver's license, hadn't driven a car.
Driving a Hummer.
He had to drive a Hummer.
Where did he get the Hummer from?
One of the lawyers, he actually said, well, this is all I have, so you'll have to take the driving test in this. And James thought that was so funny. He just told me, he said, that thing was bigger than my prison cell.
Exactly.
But every agency, it was the same problem. We don't have a record. We'll have to recreate this human being and get him acclimated back out into society. James was not able to lease an apartment. That was done by his law firm.
Right. Has conditions and circumstances gotten any better since then? Has those kind of issues been addressed?
They're being addressed, and because Texas leads the nation in DNA and non-DNA exonerations. And, of course, Dallas has had more than any jurisdiction in the country.
Exactly.
30 men have been exonerated since the year 2001. That's a steady revolving door of men coming out of Texas prison. So I think the good news is, in Dallas especially and in Texas generally, that these men have banded together to produce a sort of sad fraternity of brothers.
Right.
And they actually help provide services for each other because they don't want any man to get out and suffer what they did, having to reconstruct a life, especially the men who did not have as many family members as some others. Because there's no support network if you don't have family.
We had
one exoneree who Billy Smith, by the way, who recently died a few weeks ago here in Dallas. Billy was a good friend. He and his wife were good friends to James and to me, and I miss Billy terribly. Billy used to tell me all the time, you know, I lost 10 family members while I was incarcerated.
Right, exactly.
When I got out, I was trying to figure out, well, where am I going to stay? Where am I going to go? My family's dead.
Speaking of family, James's sister was a piece of work.
Oh, my God. Yes.
To say it mildly.
She really made life difficult for us. She was very tightly wound, very religious, and just very...
Well, that's debatable from reading in the book about her religious inklings.
Well, you're right, but she had a tendency to preach at us.
Okay.
And James was really put off by that because I think he had heard so much of that in prison.
Mm-hmm.
It really rubbed him the wrong way. And he did ask me a lot, how can people out here claim to be Christians when they're the farthest thing from it? I hear what they say and I see what they do. He had a hard time, you know, finding out, how can I get close to my sister? I don't even know this woman. I feel like she's a total stranger to me. It wasn't the young lady that he remembered and loved when he went away.
I found it ironic that, you know, he brings $5,000 to her house in cash and she throws it in his face. I mean, that's just, I don't know.
I almost passed out when she did that. I was so worried about James's response to that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, would it promote or provoke another seizure? Because he was under so much stress.
Right.
I mean, we had people telling us what we should do with the money when the money came. We had people asking us for money before James ever got compensated. And I dare say, looking back at all of it now,
mm-hmm.
I think if those people knew how the Timothy Cole compensation law worked,
right,
they would have tried a little bit harder to keep him alive.
Okay. I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to come to the Timothy Cole compensation. How did that come about here in the state of Texas?
Well, there was a contingent of us working all over the state. We fanned out, and a lot of the credit goes to the exonerees. We went to Austin a number of times so that the exonerees could tell legislators their stories so they could hear why we needed to revisit the compensation law, the old compensation law that Texas already had on the books. It needed to be improved. It needed to be revisited. And so we got permission from the family of Timothy Cole, who died in prison before he could be proven innocent, but
mm-hmm.
he was eventually proven innocent. I got to work with Timothy Cole's mother and brother, Corey Session, and the late Mrs. Ruby Session, an angel. And once they allowed Tim's name to be on the compensation package, that really opened a lot of doors for us to go in and shake hands, to do radio interviews, to write stories. I remember writing a story for the Austin American Statesman that same year about why lawmakers needed to pass this bill to give these exonerees health care, college tuition, to give them more money than they were giving at that time. So it worked out that once it passed, Rick Perry said he would sign it, and it is the most comprehensive, generous compensation law in the whole country.
No, that's right. Speaking of former Governor Rick Perry, you all hanging out in Highland Park, and the governor's there, and he eventually asks James, you know, how he's doing. And you say, well, he's doing pretty good, and he would do better if you would sign him a pardon. And James
absolutely
got kind
correct.
Of upset, and but you were serious business about, you know, he's doing fine, but he'll be doing better because he couldn't receive the compensation without a full pardon.
That is one of the stipulations of the Timothy Cole compensation law. You are not even eligible for compensation in the state of Texas until you receive a full pardon from the governor of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I could not tell James that we were going to a private party in Highland Park on a Sunday evening.
Right.
He never would have left. He never would have left the house. And, you know, on the ride over, he kept asking, where'd you say we're going again? Yeah, and I was so nervous, like, oh, please stop asking me, James. We're going to a garden party. He thought that was hilarious. He said, a what?
Mm-hmm.
I said, a garden party. And he just did the most hilarious things all the time to make me laugh. And so he didn't want to go. He did not want to go. And we pull up in front of his house. It has a red carpet,
right,
like you walk on up to the front door, and they had valet parking, and it's a beautiful mansion in Highland Park. And James looks at me. He says, say, whose house did you say this was? I'm still trying to push him inside. We get inside, and we are the only black people at the party.
Of course.
Even the wait staff is white. You know,
mm-hmm.
the people bringing us drinks and food are white. James shot me a look I will never forget. He was sweating bullets, and I said, James, honey, please relax. Would you stop? Would you just stop? He said, well, why am I here? He said, I know that you hang out with some of these people and they know you and all of that. He said, but I don't belong here. And finally, the hostess of the party says to me, a friend of yours is over there, and he has his back to us. And I'm carrying James over, and I don't want this man to turn around because I'm pretty sure James will run off if he sees Rick Perry when he turns around. And I tapped him on the shoulder. The governor turned around, and James froze. His whole face just, you could see the shock. And I introduced James as the 17th Dallas man exonerated. And, of course, instantly Rick Perry knew who it was.
Who it was, exactly.
And he saw James's hand was trembling. He knew James was very nervous. And he just brushed his hand aside and he grabbed him and hugged him. And, and that almost made James fall apart. And he said, well, Mr. Woodard, is the state of Texas doing everything for you that she's supposed to be? And James was going, yes, sir. And I was like, no, oh, wait. I said, wait a minute. I said, no. And, you know, and of course I told the governor, I gave the governor a piece of my mind. I said, yeah, he'd be doing much better if you would sign that pardon that's been sitting on your desk for weeks. And James really literally looked at me like I cursed the Pope. Who talks like that to the governor? And he couldn't believe it. And then Governor Perry's sister came over, and she hugged me, and James was so confused. He's trying to be, well, you know, they must have adopted my fiance. Who? She knows the whole family.
Right.
But finally, I had a private moment with Rick Perry to tell him, James is a good guy. Please sign his pardon so that he can try to get on with his life. And he asked me a few questions, you know, about James, and he said he had a very good feeling about him, and a day later, Rick Perry called me from Austin. He called me at home, and he said, hey, girl. He said, guess what I'm doing? I said, I don't know, running the state? He said, no. He said, I've just signed a full pardon for James Woodard. And I said, oh, my God. I said, did you tell him? He said, no. He said, I think he'd rather hear it from you.
Exactly.
And I went downstairs and told him.
What was it like having to deal with those horrific car accidents? I mean, James tore up some expensive cars, and the wreckage was extensive. It's a wonder he got out alive from those accidents.
That's a really good question, because I don't even know. It was like some other Joyce King would take over my being to become Nurse Nightingale, and I still don't know where that inner strength came from all of those times that James nearly died. In 4.5 years, James crashed 8 vehicles, and they were almost all luxury cars. And 2010 was probably the worst, because he had just bought us a brand new Mercedes for Christmas that I didn't want. And I remember, you know, arguing with him about this car. We're at the dealership fighting. I don't want to spend this money when we don't need another car. And James was adamant that, you know, this was my Christmas gift. And we owned that car a whole month. January 2010, James literally flew off Interstate 35, crossed 5 lanes of traffic. How he missed the other cars near him was amazing to me. He had suffered a seizure where he basically, his head just went back while he was driving. And the car continued to accelerate. Witnesses said there were never any brake lights that went on. He went down an embankment, flipped several times. He hit another vehicle. He finally was stopped by a tree. That was the only thing that stopped him, and the car was upside down. I don't think the paramedics that came really thought James was alive. All they could see was what looked like a bloody dead man.
Exactly.
He wasn't moving, and they had to use the jaws of life to extract him from the vehicle. And by that time, the care flight had arrived, and so he was taken to Parkland, which was the nearest hospital and the best hospital. And I just really knew when I heard all the details that James was, how could he have survived? Right. His head was cracked open, ribs were broken, his back was broken, and I was amazed that James was alive when I heard all of these details. So that was probably the hardest one to recover from, because I had to give him care night and day, 24/7, and one of the worst things for James was the fact that I had to dress and undress him, feed him, bathe him. He hated bath time, by the way.
I understand.
which made him ever more humble. I had a new appreciation for what caregivers do.
But then it gets better. It gets better to the point that he's finally released from the hospital, because I think the hospital has had enough of James. But he wants he wants to go see the car.
Oh my God.
He wants to go see the car, and then he falls out at the Dallas Police Impound.
Yes. I mean, it was so terrifying that we've just been released and let go from Parkland, and they've given me all of these strict instructions on the fact that he's, you know, if he hits his head, he could die. Mm-hmm. And so, that's quite a bit of pressure for me to know that I'm the only thing standing between James and him not hitting his head and dying. James insists on seeing the 2010, the new Mercedes, and I. Mm-hmm. I don't want James to see this car because he has no memory of the accident. And,
exactly.
And truth be told, there's no car to see.
Really, it isn't.
And I put a photo of that
in the
book.
I know, in the book. Yeah, it's like something that was on its way to the I guess, when they crush cars and make them out of squares and send them off to the and sell them at scrap metal. That's what it looks like.
I actually snapped that photo with my cell phone because James was going to have a fit. He was, you know, he was threatening to go on his own. And finally I said, James, you have to behave, honey. I will drive you to the impound lot, let you see. But once he got there, he became very agitated. He wanted to stand outside. He wouldn't sit down. He wanted to smoke a cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctors had already told him, James, no smoking. You need to stop smoking.
Right.
So he went outside and, you know, as we used to say in the old neighborhood, he bummed a cigarette off
mm-hmm.
of some dude.
Right.
And I'm trying to watch him. I'm in the line. I'm trying to watch him. It's like a tennis match.
And then people are watching you all because they feel something is getting ready to jump off.
They knew something was definitely wrong with this man and this woman. And James had been very vocal when he was inside the place to the point where,
mm-hmm.
you know, people moved away from us. Like, you know, is this about to be a domestic abuse situation? And finally, it was almost like it happened in slow motion. I turned to look at him.
Mm-hmm.
He had taken a puff, a drag of a smoke. And when I turned again, I saw James falling, and it was nothing I could do. I couldn't rush to make it in time. I saw James hit the pavement front full force, and the impact frightened me to where I just froze when I was running. I just froze when I saw, oh, my God, and I knew he was dead. And before I could get to him, I believe it was a Dallas police officer because I saw the uniform. He actually got to James before I did, and there was a crowd around him in no time because I think that they thought he was dead, too, because here's a guy who still has his head wrapped.
Exactly.
So they already know something is wrong, and his head was still swollen. It was very large. So he looked like Frankenstein almost.
Right. And he had some kind of body armor on that was protecting.
Yes, he did.
Okay, right.
They had put that on at the hospital because they didn't want James to move his back in a particular way. It had to stay still. It had to stay straight. And so he was complaining and griping all the way over to the impound lot. Get me out of this contraption. I want to be out of this thing. You know, and I said, James, that thing is saving your life. We had that discussion in the car. So it's amazing that he would fall from the sidewalk onto the pavement face first. And I had them to turn him over. They first said they did not want to move him.
Mm-hmm.
This was the police officer talking. And I said, no, I said, he needs to see me. And when they turned him over, James was in a full-blown seizure on top of everything else. And it was just, I said, okay, all of my senses kicked in. I have to be calm. I have to get through this. I have to tell them what to do. So the crowd is around me, and they're yelling, what's his name? What's his name? And I said, James.
Right.
And he says, come on, James. And they were, you know, and I said, what? This is like being stuck in a movie.
Exactly.
It literally was. I had so many dramatic moments with this man and things that would have maybe driven another person crazy. But he woke up. Came out of the seizure, and he was looking right at me, and I said, that's it, James, stay with me. Look at me, baby, look at me.
Right.
And he was looking at me, and I knew he could hear me. He couldn't really talk, but I knew he could hear me.
As you mentioned,
the ambulance came.
As you mentioned, crazy, you did go see a psychiatrist.
I did, because I felt like this happened after James died. I thought there must be something wrong with a person who stayed so long trying to save a person's life. Is there something wrong with me? Am I under that much stress? I mean, I wasn't sleeping. I was totally grief-stricken over James. I was worried that this was more than normal grief, and I wanted to pull through it. I wanted to be okay, and the psychiatrist told me, he said, you've already figured it out. He said, there's nothing wrong with you. He said, you're totally normal. He said, you loved a man. There's nothing wrong with that. And he kind of made a joke that, you know, if I were a young man, because he was older than me, the psychiatrist, he said, if I were a younger man, I'd want a woman to love me that hard.
What do you want readers to come away with once they've read the book?
I want readers to know that I absolutely still love James. You don't stop loving a person because they die or they leave you or they go on to live a different life without you. And I always wanted the best for him and for him to have some enjoyment after 30 years of a nightmare wrongful incarceration. And I've had plenty of people tell me, you know, James really did love you. You were the happiness. You were the bright spot. It didn't matter. The $4 million did not compare to Joyce King. And that's what I want readers to come away with, that we did have a great love.
Well, I want to thank you for your effort. It gave me a little bit more insight about you, but it also gave me insight on the justice system and some of the things that we need to do to improve what we do for exonerees as far as more so than the compensation of actually looking at some of the mental health problems that they experience while they're in prison. And that carries over once they've been released. And that's something that probably needs to be dealt with long-term instead of short-term and just sending these individuals out here on their own to fend for themselves.
That's absolutely right, John. Thank you so much for having me on and for being such a staunch supporter of my work, of the columns, of hate crime. And I just want to add that we're in the middle of a 1 million readers campaign.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Go ahead.
Well, we launched the campaign at SMU, very successful a few weeks ago, and the mission is to get 1 million courageous people who will read The Story of a Dragging in Jasper, Texas, which was a book that was published by Random House in 2002. I've got the old Oprah footage up on Facebook. If anyone would like to see that, just search 1 million readers and you'll see it. And we want people to be brave enough to read this finally, because the 20-year anniversary of the dragging is in June 2018, and people need to know that the proceeds from the 1 million readers campaign go to fund the work that I am doing currently of reviewing more wrongful convictions in the state of Louisiana.
Joyce F. King, broadcaster, columnist, and author of Exonerated, A Brief and Dangerous Freedom. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Remember to like us on Facebook and to follow us on Twitter. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.